Welcome to the realm of heroes and monsters. Storytime with your host, A.P. Fuchs. Stories of intrigue, stories of horror, stories of superheroics, stories of monsters. Get ready, the thrill ride begins.
All right, this is it, guys. Welcome aboard Season 2, Episode 2 of the Realm of Heroes and Monsters Storytime with AP Fuchs podcast. So here we are. Last week, we did our first episode with the new format. And as you know, if you tuned in, you could tell it was quite a bit longer, quite different compared to Season 1. So I'm glad to have given you something different. You know, I believe in when it comes to this whole creative thing and presenting different stories and ideas and concepts and whatever to people is to, like, you know, shake it up, right? Turn around, try something new, take a common angle or perhaps even a common theme or a common something, and then try to do something new with it. And of course, like, podcasts are fairly, well, they're quote unquote new, but in reality, they've been around for years and years and years. So at the same time, I'm trying to do the same thing with this podcast, right? We did a Season 1 with one version of story time, and now we're doing Season 2 with another version. In other words, changing it up. We're trying to do something new with something that's common. So here we are. And like last episode, I'm not going to go crazy with the intro. Last intro, of course, was a bit longer because we had to explain the show what's going on, that sort of thing. But now we don't have to do that. Now we can just get into the show straight away, and we're going to get into story time right away coming up for something very important to this tale that you're about to hear. Like, I'll give you the story behind the story after, but this tale that you're about to hear, well, let's just say it's the birth of something. The birth of something big, the birth of something dark, the birth of something dangerous. So close your eyes, listen in, let your imagination take over, and listen to the story about a little boy who got more than he bargained for. The little boy who would. It didn't really look like her, Jean thought, but it was close enough. He had drawn his mom's face and colored it in as best he could using the crayons from the same box he had since the first grade. He was in grade 4 now. After drawing up his mother's portrait on the 6-inch squared piece of paper, he taped it to the empty soda bottle he had bought at the Rocky Hill with him. "This'll show her," he thought. The anger inside still hadn't abated, even though what his mom did happened about an hour before. After setting the bottle on top of a boulder that was about the shoulder height, he bent down and picked up a stone the size of a large marble and pulled his slingshot from his back pocket. Straightening, he nestled the rock in the loading pouch. Setting the slingshot to his shoulder as though a rifle, he turned about-faced and marched 10 paces. "Ready?" He stuck the slingshot out in front of him, one hand on the grip, the other maintaining the stone in the loading pouch. "Aim!" He spun around and aligned the bell of the slingshot's Y with the bottle. "Fire!" He released the stone. It was a tiny gray blur as it cut through the air. "This is what you get," he thought. He was so sure the stone was going to hit the bottle land squarely between his mother's eyes. Instead, it sailed right over. Jean threw the slingshot to the ground. "Crap, man," he spat. "It's your fault." His mom had made him so angry, even his concentration was ruined. Stuffing his hands in his pockets, he stood staring at the ground for a moment before bending down to pick up the slingshot. As his fingers trailed along the ground before curling themselves under the handle, he inadvertently rubbed away some of the gravelly dust beneath the slingshot and revealed a small spot of glassy purple. Looking closer and wiping more of the dust away with the sleeve of his jean jacket, he uncovered a patch of purple crystal. If it was black, it could have easily been mistaken for mica. He never knew a rock could be purple, though. A few feet away was another small mound of gravel dust. Jean went over to it, squatted down, and batted it away with his sleeve, like he had the other. Beneath it was another smear of purple crystal, this one a little bigger than the other by a good inch or two around. "Cool," he said, and scratched at it, thinking maybe he could dig it up. The crystal was as part of the rocky hill he was on as were the boulders that jutted out from it. In his peripheral, he noticed patches of gravel dust began dotting the ground around him, springing up out of the hill like weeds from dirt. Where is it coming from? He thought. The crystal at his feet. What if it was like gold? What if it was worth tons and tons of money? Though only 9 years old, he knew the value of money and that if you had enough of it, you can get anything you wanted. Maybe you can do whatever you want too, he thought. It certainly was possible. After all, Flin Flon, where he lived, was a mining town and was founded because of gold. But how did all those miners miss the purple crystal? Were they blind? I don't care, he said. It's mine now. Hear me, Ma? It's mine now. Mine, 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 and with it I can get all the BB guns I want. 40 zillion of them, if I wanted to. He walked over to the soda bottle, staring a hole into his mom. You won't be able to tell me what to do ever again. Ever. Slingshot still in hand, he wound up, making sure the hard plastic of the V part of the Y would hit it square on, and swung at the bottle. Chink! The bottle went sailing, as did his mom. The tinny, glassy ring of the bottle shattering against stone made him smile. He had more crystal to find. 3/4 of an hour later, every small mound of gravel dust had been wiped away. Over 100 shiny patches of purple crystal sparkled in the sun. Admiring all the work he accomplished, he wiped the sweat off his forehead with his sleeve. "Where is everyone?" he said. No one had come by since he'd been up here. He should have seen another kid or four by now. Nearly everyone in his class had been on this hill at one time or another, and some of the guys he knew spent nearly every day there, wiping with rocks and playing war and throwing rocks at each other. Weird, he added. Squinting, he glanced over the many patches of purple, hoping to see some kind of pattern. The only pattern, which seemed more of an actual design, was some of the patches were closer together than others. The patches ran in a row over a distance of about 20 feet, then reared inward like a hook of a cane. Gene followed the curve, quickly realizing his walking along the cane's arc was taking longer than covering the two right turns. The arc kept going, spiraling inward, circle after circle. Though the cane's arc originally covered about 15 feet widthwise, Gene knew he was walking a lot further than that. The spiral's path grew tighter and tighter with each pass. Try as he might, he couldn't take his eyes off the shiny purple patches of smooth crystal between his feet. There was this nagging feeling lurking in the back of his thoughts that told him if he did look up, he'd lose the trail and have to start all over again. But there was more to it than that, which caused him to worry. Not only was he sure he'd stray off the path, however small and tight it already was, he'd also fall off it, too. Plunge forever into a void or chasm of some kind, never to be saved or found. A minute later, it felt like his eyes were spinning and turning and twisting and rolling in their sockets. His stomach contracted and expanded in sickening bursts of what he called the puke pump. The back of his throat brought to life the taste of that morning's bacon and eggs, digested and used. His brain seemed as if it was spinning inside his skull like a plate did when he held it down with one finger and rotated it with the other. Knees shaking, tears turning the grayish brown of the rock and the smooth bits of purple into a distorted mosaic, his puke pump about to launch a healthy dose of chunky throw up, Gene glanced away from the path. The ground disappeared beneath him. Hello, Gene. Huh? Hello, Gene. Who's there? Hello, Gene. Who's talking? Gene. Hello. Shut up. Turn on the lights. Hello, Gene. Stop saying my name. Hello, Gene. Screaming, Gene spun around in the dark, took a few running steps, then stopped abruptly. Something was in front of him. Someone. Gene. A jolt shot from his hips to the base of his skull. His legs turned to jelly. Who's there? He asked. Someone was there. He heard them breathing. It sounded old, like the way his grandpa breathed. Shaking, not knowing whether to turn around, look up, or feel what or who was ahead, Gene yelped when a hand touched him on the shoulder from behind. "Let me go, let me go!" "Gene, hello? Want a BB gun?" "No, I don't want anything. Let me go now. Now!" "I can give it to you, you know. I can give you more than one, too. I can make it happen." Screaming, Gene took free from the fingers grasping his shoulder and ran into the dark. Looking up, hoping to see an opening, anything that revealed where he fell. His heart broke when there was nothing. No light, no hole showing a blue sky, just darkness. Stomping his foot, he turned in a circle again, doing his best to keep calm. But in spite of any self-reassurances he was going to be okay, his heart steadily beat harder and harder. "Gene." The voice, low and spellbinding. "Who is that? Tell me." "I am magic. I am charm. I make everything okay." Breaking down, face in his hands, Gene sunk to his knees. Was he going to die? Who was with him in the dark? Curse his mother. If she didn't say no to letting him have a BB gun, he wouldn't be down here. He was going to use his own money for Pete's sake. He saved nearly every stinking cent earned from his paper route that summer. It was his money, and he could do with it what he wanted. He deserved it. But no, his stupid mother had to have a hatred for guns, for any weapons. She didn't even want him to have his slingshot, but thank God for Dad's. His dad was able to talk his mom into letting him have the slingshot, but only if he agreed to always use it outside and never ever aim it at anyone or anything alive. That even included the trees, as far as his mother was concerned. That was why he always went to the hill every time he wanted to fire a few off. "It's okay, Gene. I'm here for you. Do you want to go home?" "Yes, let me out of here." He wiped his eyes, partly ashamed he was crying. Such a baby. "Can I come with you?" His lower lip trembled as more tears came to his eyes. Try as he might, he couldn't bite back the tears. "I don't know." He wiped his eyes again. "Mom!" The back of his throat burned from his scream. Swallowing was like trying to down a jawbreaker. "Mom!" Coughing, a sickening metal taste filled his mouth. He spat. It was so dark he couldn't even see he accidentally spat on his shoes. He only felt it. "Dad! Mom! Help!" Mouth dry, lips pasty, he winced when whoever was in the dark with him spoke again. "If you had that BB gun, you wouldn't be down here now, would you? If you had that BB gun, you wouldn't be in the dark with me. If you had that BB gun, you wouldn't be crying." "Quiet!" he demanded. He spun on his heels and after one step found himself under the yellow of a street lamp, that antique kind you saw in history books and old movies. The lamp cast a small circle of light, perhaps only 7 or so feet from one side to the other. Gene ran to the lamppost and hugged it tight. The post's black metal was warm and comforting. He hung on to it for a good while before letting go. When he turned around, a glossy wooden table with round legs and a chair with a round seat were now in a circle with him. He glanced up at the street lamp again, a brief beat of dull pain pulsing against the back of his eyes. When he looked at the table again, a deck of blue, flower-patterned cards sat neatly at the table's center. Gene went over to it. "Sit down." "What?" "I said, sit down." Gene grabbed the chair and quickly sat on it, the firmness of the voice compelling him to listen. He waited. The lamp buzzed. The air warmed. Time to play. Out of the shadows, a young man, perhaps 20, stepped out. He wore a gray sweatshirt and tight blue jeans with white sneakers. His brown hair was cropped short, a buzz cut like the kind you'd find in the military. His blue eyes, gentle as his mother's touch, set Gene at ease. "Hello," the man said. His voice was soft and clear, sounding nothing like the haunting voice Gene had heard coming from the darkness moments before. "Hi," Gene replied. The man came over, his eyes never leaving Gene's. He sat down. "We're going to play a game." What kind of game?" "I'm not supposed to talk to strangers." The man glanced at the cards on the table and stuck out his hand for a handshake. "I'm Bill, by the way. I already know your name." Jean nodded. His heart sped up, but quickly slowed when Bill's reassuring eyes comforted him. "It's a very simple game," Bill said. He picked up the deck of cards from the table and split it in the middle. "This is a deck of cards."
"Yeah, duh,"
Bill grinned. "There are two halves. One, in my left, has blue flowers on the back. The other, red flowers. But remember, they are from the same deck. With me so far?"
"Sure,"
Jean said. "Do you think I'm stupid or something?" He slid his chair closer to the table. The fact he was in a strange, dark place somewhere below the rocky hill didn't cross his mind. It was cozy here, like it was when you curled up in bed and hid beneath your quilt. "Each half has two suits. You do know what a suit is, right?" Bill said.
"Yep.
Hearts and diamonds and spades and clubs. Oh, and jokers, too."
"Very good. But this deck is a little different. Each suit is numbered 1 through 13. There are no face cards. No ace, either. Just a 1 instead. And no jokers. Got it?"
"Yes." His right thigh rapidly bounced up and down, a nervous habit. "Now, we each get half the deck, the one with the red flowers or the one with the blue." He gesticulated with each half deck. "Now here's how the game works. We flip a coin to see who goes first. Whoever goes first can choose to lay down either one card or two. If you lay down two, each card must be from a different suit. The suits that belong to the red deck are reason and fear. The suits belonging to the blue are wishes and hope."
"How do you decide who gets what color?" Jean asked.
"The older person gets the blue. The young..." "What if there are more than two players?"
"Then the oldest person gets blue, wishes. The next oldest blue, hope. The next oldest after that, reason. The last, fear."
"What if twins are playing?"
"Then they take their pick. Now listen, the cards are numbered 1 to 13. You lay down either one card or two. If you put down two, each card has to be from a different suit, okay?
Scenario. If you lay down, say, a 2 of wishes, I could beat it with a 3 or higher from the fear suit. If I lay down a 1 of fear, then you beat me and we start over with you deciding to lay down one card or two. And, of course, the same applies for suits reason and hope. But wishes can't compete with reason and hopes can't compete with fear. All right?" Jean played the rules over in his head. The game seemed simple enough. It was kind of like war, but with slightly more to it.
"Yep, I got it."
"Then let's begin." Bill won the first three hands, fear dominating two of them and reason the other. But Jean came back in the fourth hand and stomped out Bill's 2 of reason with an immense 12 of hope. The victory warmed his heart and he couldn't help but smile.
"You caught on," Bill said.
"Yep, sure did," Jean said. Bill set down a pair of sixes, one from fear and the other from reason.
"Say if you lay down a 5 of reason and a 6 of fear," Jean said, "and I lay down a 7 of hope, but only a 2 of wishes. That's a tie, right?"
"Depends on the numerical difference between the suits. Using your example, if you lay down a 7 of hope, you beat my 5 of reason by 2. However, your wishes lost by 2 fear by a value of 4. Which is greater, 2 or 4?
4, he murmured, then spoke up. "But what if I beat one of them by 3 and lost another by 3? Then what?"
"Dennis declared an official tie, and each of us get a point. In this case, you have to beat my fear card with a 7 or higher. Same with my reason card."
"What if..."
"Just play." Eyeing Bill's 2 sixes, Jean drew 1 card from each of his own piles, and when he flipped them over, he was relieved when he saw he had turned over an 8 of hope and a 10 of wishes. Bill proffered a golfer's clap.
"Bravo, Jean. Well done."
"Gee, thanks, mister. Bill, I meant to say." Grinning, Bill straightened his reason and fear decks. Jean leaned down his next card. "Only 1 this time, a 1 of wishes."
"Just 1 wish," he thought absentmindedly.
"But what is your wish?" Bill asked.
"Just..."
He bit his tongue. "Mom said no. I just hope that..."
she would buy it for me. His heart was heavy. All they wanted was a BB rifle. Is that bad? No, Bill said. It is not bad. You had a desire and you had it turned down. It happens. Sometimes you don't get what we want. Gene sat back and folded his arms, frowning. We should. Do you think the world would be a better place if everyone got what they wanted? I know I'd be happy if I got everything I wanted, he thought. Yeah, then people wouldn't get mad when they couldn't get what they really wanted. Bill paused a moment, squinting one eye. Then he said, can I tell you a secret? Shrugging first and sitting back in his seat, Gene said, yeah? When you beat me there with your stronger wishes and hope cards against my fear and reason cards, you helped someone achieve what they wanted, get what they wanted. I did? How? This guy was a nut. These are special cards, Gene, Bill said. And if you and I keep playing, and if you keep winning, you can help other people get what they want. Really? But how do I keep on winning? Well, the only bit of advice I can give you is that you listen to your heart when it comes to choosing to lay down one or two cards whenever it's your turn to start a hand. Remember, with two cards, you risk a chance of a tie. And though we each get a point, someone out there gets what they want and someone else doesn't. Then I can play just one card all the time, he thought cleverly. Okay. Bill said they would finish their current game to begin the next hand. I'm going to beat you, you know, Gene said. I don't know about that. There are a lot of people to help. Whenever you're ready, let's go. Even after all this time, Gene was still shamed by his nakedness. The years, he had outgrown his pants and underwear long ago. He only wore his sweatshirt when he was cold, and that lasted only a short time until the pressure of a boy's shirt against a man's frame was too restrictive, making it difficult to breathe. Now a man, mid-30s would be his guess, but he didn't know how long he'd been down here. His dark hair long and matted, hanging down to his bottom, his beard almost as long, hanging past his gut. His skin was pale and blistered with sores. Some of his wounds still hadn't healed. He hadn't had a real meal in decades. Many years before, after several hours of playing that card game of wishes and hope and reason and fear, Gene had wanted to leave. Bill wouldn't let him. Bill said there was no way out. He said he had to keep playing, keep helping people. So Gene played a little longer and asked to leave again. Bill still said no. Figuring it was only a matter of time before Bill would call it quits from being too tired, Gene thought he'd escape while Bill was asleep. But Bill didn't sleep that night, or any other to follow. Bill never slept. Only allowed to rest a bit here and there, Gene was told he had to keep playing the game, keep helping people get what they wanted, keep satisfying wishes and hopes and warding off fear, getting things sometimes, in spite of reason. Perhaps a week or so into the game, Gene threw over the table, the cards scattering across the stone floor. He told Bill to rot in hell and refused to play. What a mistake, Gene thought. He remembered Bill somehow appearing behind him and with thick fingers grabbing him by the scruff of the neck, dragging him into the darkness. Gene never forgot the first time he felt the hot sting of a lead-beaded whip tear into his back. Never forgot the soothing warmth of blood oozing over the wounds, temporarily washing away the pain. From then on, with each refusal to play, he was beaten. With each attempt at escape, he was beaten worse. Bill barely fed him, only gave him enough food and water to survive, but not enough to keep him strong. Head heavy, eyes drooping, Gene was prepared to sell his soul just to die and be rid of Bill and that blasted card game. But you're helping people, Gene thought. You're doing the right thing, but you're also losing your own life. There's no way out. There's nothing down here except Bill and fear and reason and wishes and... There was no hope. Not anymore. Gene looked at Bill's 11 of fear. I have a 2-in-13 chance of beating him and a 1-in-13 chance of tying him. He'd played this hand hundreds of times before. Sometimes he won and sometimes not. If his stomach wasn't so empty, he would throw up from just looking at the cards. Instead, he was forced to endure nauseating throbs and gut-twisting sickness. He forced himself to remain seated at the table, forced himself to play. Hand trembling, he reached for the deck of wishes, not caring if he won or lost. If he helped someone receive the thing or a person or feeling they wanted most, or if the person broke down inside from a desire unmet and they became self-destructive to ward off the pain, doesn't matter, he thought. It's because of them, those selfish, no-good, filthy, stupid people, that I'm here. Taking a card, he paused before turning it over. What would Mom say? She'd want you to hope for the best, to help others. His inner monologue still carried the voice of a 9-year-old, but then, in a darker and lower voice, that of a man. Screw her. She didn't give you that BB gun. It was just a toy rifle, a stupid toy. Mom, she's why you're here. If it weren't for her... He flipped the card over. It was an 8 of wishes. Blast them all, he said. Bill didn't say anything. He never said anything. Not anymore. Who Gene once thought of as a kind man who only wanted to help people, who is now just some sort of demonic host at a never-ending gaming party. Knowing that Bill knew, he knew there was nothing he could do to escape. He just wanted to die. And that's what I'm going to do after this game is over and I'm allowed to sleep, he thought. If he lets me sleep. Hope, foreign yet familiar, finally came. Ambling through the dark, Gene went to the corner of what he was dubbed his cell, a small room 6 1/2 grown man paces by 7, double that when he was a kid. Bill had introduced him to the room the first time he slept down here, beneath the earth, away from his mother, his life, and everything else he once knew. His mother, she must have been worried sick because of him. Even now, he still never accepted that. In her mind, he was presumed dead. But they never found a body, he thought. He could only imagine her guilt, or how many times she must have wished she would have gone after him the day he stomped out of the house. All over a BB rifle. So stupid. The toy that everyone wanted and some had no longer meant a thing. The day he stopped caring was the day he saw the toy next to his chair, leaning up against the seat, just waiting for him to finally pick it up, cradle it. The object that led him to a life of fear and reason and wishes and hope. Can I go now? He had asked Bill that day. If it was day, that was. He slept so little that night that day and night became one. Gently placing a hand on his shoulder, Bill said very simply, no, and crossed to the other side of the table and sat down. Even after years of playing a game, he could barely stand. Even after giving up his life to help others, even after receiving the toy that had caused him so much pain, and in a way things have come in full circle, his life was still forfeit. He tried to kill Bill that day. He dove over the table and tackled him to the floor. The moment they landed, Gene found himself flipped onto his back, Bill on top of him. His captor's hard knuckles smashing over and over into his face. The pain. Now in his room without light, crouched in the corner, Gene held the rifle for the first time in years. It was heavier than he remembered it, but he was also thinner now, weaker than the day he first received it. I'm so sorry, Mom, he thought. He then whispered, so sorry. I don't deserve anything. Should never have asked for this thing. It's just a gun, just a stupid gun used to kill people, things, me. Tears leaked from the corners of his eyes and rolled down his cheeks. The salty liquid stung his dry, cracked skin. He didn't wipe the tears away. He deserved the discomfort. He didn't deserve reprieve. He set the rifle barrel beneath his chin, resting its butt in on the ground. Finally, he thought, peace. He pulled the trigger. The empty click that echoed in the small stone room was as devastating as if a real bullet had discharged. Just a pellet, he remembered, not a bullet. He hadn't checked to see the weapon had it was loaded with BB pellets the toy was supposed to come with. Actually, he had forgotten it was just a toy. If only it could have discharged, if only... I don't understand you, Gene. This is how you thank me for giving you what you wanted? Bill said from behind him. The way the man could sneak up on you, so silently, chilled the nerves. Anguish wrenched Jean's heart at the sound of Bill's voice. He dropped the rifle and placed his face in his hands. I'm sorry. The words were like pins pricking his heart and mind, the painful piercings he deserved. What do you want me to do? He asked. He's going to whip the hell out of me again. No, he whispered. No more. Just kill me. It's too late for that, Jean. I gave you what you wanted. You ignored it. I gave you the chance to help people, prevent them from suffering, from being without the thing they wanted most, and you tried to end your ability to help them with a toy. No, it's not like that. I just want to go home. I just want to go... Somehow, without making a sound, Bill was right next to him, his thick hands pressing down on his shoulders, gripping him, holding him so he couldn't move. From this day forward, you will serve with others, Bill said. You will grant their wishes and erase their fears. You will give them hope and oppose any reason, even reason itself, so they can achieve peace. Bill leaned closer, his hot breath tickling the inside of Jean's ear. You will not rest until everyone living is helped. Every single one. Tears flowed freely. Jean could barely find the strength to speak. But that's impossible. I can't. Too long. I can't do it. Releasing him, Bill stood. I know. Hey, welcome to the story behind the story segment. You know, it's funny how these things are labeled. It's just like chunk by chunk. Well, welcome to this, welcome to that. Anyway, story behind the story. So the story you just heard was dark. I mean, it was dark. It involved a kid, right? And writing kids, I mean, I write kids, of course, with other fiction, but, you know, you gotta be careful with the kids, because, you know, we have rules in society regarding kids, and that's a good thing that we have those rules in place. But even when it comes to writing kids, you gotta be careful, because you have to not present something or do something or write something that would be considered basically illegal, right? Like something that is would fall under the category of hate literature, so to speak. You know, you got to be careful how you treat kids on the page. You can't get into details on certain things. You can mention them, sure, but you cannot, for certain things, yeah, you can't go into detail. So this case, we involved a kid, and this time we took him up to Flin Flon. And the story behind the story there is simply this. That's where I have heritage, and I've been up there a few times, and it's really cool. I mean, way different than here in the city in Winnipeg. Everything is on hills, everything is rocks everywhere, and so I thought it'd be a great place to set the story because of the rock factor. These giant, huge hill-sized rocks, right? And I thought, if I'm going to tell the origin story of the Magic Man, we need to be in a location that's, you know, out of the way, but at the same time where people can be involved. So Flin Flon was picked for that reason, and then the rock portion, the hill portion, I was picked because with those, of course, what lurks inside, right? We don't look at any movie, any book, you know, mountains and hills contain anything, right? So that's why that was picked. But I wanted to show, you know, the story behind the story on this one, outside of simply showing the Magic Man origin, was the tragedy of the Magic Man. I mean, in episode one, you heard a story about him, and it was dark and horrible, and he's this bad villain. But in this one, I wanted to show you why, what happened, you know, and we got to see, this kid playing this card game over and over and over and over and over again. Eventually, you'd start to lose your mind, especially in his case where he's played it his whole life, nonstop. Eventually, he loses his clothes, he's unkept, you know, not showered, like nothing, barely eaten, frail, and ultimately, at the end, cursed. And, I wanted to show, I think it's important when it comes to villains, any villain, you know, supernatural or natural, that they have to be kind of like that tragic villain, you know, the one that you could sympathize with, the one that you could empathize with. What they might be doing is absolutely horrible, sure, but if you're able to relate to the villain in some way, then you're able to sort of come around to their point of view. You know, and it's not means you don't have to agree with it. It just simply means that, okay, I get, yeah, if I was in this guy's head or this girl's head, I might act that way too, you know? So that's the idea, right? And like I do the same thing with the Axiom Man books, with Red Saw, the main villain there. I wanted to make him a sympathetic villain in that context, right? I want people to relate to him, to understand why he does what he does. And Magic Man is no different. So without going and saying the same thing over and over and over again, that's basically the story behind the stories. I wanted to show a villain being born, and I wanted to show why he became what he becomes. And in the end, you know, to a degree, it's not really his fault. I mean, he was an innocent kid, made a mistake, got pissed at his mom, tried to take it out on a picture of her on a glass bottle, and it led him down a path where, well, now look what happened. So, this Magic Man character. There's some more stories coming up with him, so be sure to stay tuned for those. And we'll see you next story time. But be sure to stick around till after the credits. Why? Because we have a short letter from the Magic Man himself. See you then. Thanks for sticking around to after the credits, and for your pleasure, here we have what's called the desecration of Iz. Victimization is everything when you become a slave to a system of existence, of living, of dying, and though things cannot change, you force yourself to do everything within your power to become all-powerful, all-changing, all-needing and wanting, and eventually consuming. And though you defy fate, fate defies you, and soon you seek outside help, because what we are but alone, just alone, but no matter how stronger or smart or powerful you are, there is always someone stronger and smarter and more powerful, except for me, as I have been given everything to right the wrongs and the wrong and the rights, and contrast your life as you wish it to be. However, my favors were not given to me by choice, though I was told during the card game that I chose to receive the ability to change destiny. So be it. I will acknowledge it, but never accept it, for few accept the fate we've been given. No matter what, we always must change something, as humans are selfish and pitiful creatures. I once was human, but now I'm more than man, perhaps even a god, speaking of which I do not know who or what gave me these powers, other than his name was Bill, and surely he was not a man. But now I can serve you, now I must serve you, in order to be free of this curse of aid. Yet in return for my services, I wish to have something more. You must give me yourself, and endure what I've endured, in order to receive the thing or person or state of mind or spirit that you want most. So I can ask you again, can you take it? Can you do it? Can you really give it? You really want it that badly? I know I can take it and give it, and I want you to be happy that badly, for my freedom depends on it. Yet why press you to be happy that badly, for my freedom depends on it? Yet why press in such an impossible task? Well, here's why, and that's because we are never happy with what fate has given us and what destiny has decreed to be true. By the Magic Man. Time, non-existent. Place, the cave, where nothing matters. And there you go. And the reason why it rambled on and on and on like that was because it was free thought written. If you're watching this on YouTube, you'll see that there's no punctuation in the text at all. It was meant to be full of thought, and that's the Magic Man. And of course, being as young as he was when he got transformed, yeah, he would be like this. But anyway, that's him stating, I endured, now you have to endure. See you next episode.